For a large meteor moving fast enough, hitting atmosphere can be just as destructive as hitting solid ground. In fact, if the meteor explodes mid-air, it may do more damage because an air explosion will set up a shockwave with a much wider dispersion. Scientists calculate that the Tunguska meteor blew about 4 miles above ground, which may also explain why no one has been able to find a crater or any remaining pieces. This is only one possible explanation of what happened in Tunguska. If correct, however, it's a little reminder of how small even our most powerful weapons really are when compared with the forces unleashed in nature. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from Charles Horowitz in physics. I'm Don Glass.
In sports, Chris Allen led 3 Michigan State Spartans in double figures, and number 7 Michigan State kept its hopes for a number 1 seed alive with a 64-56 victory over scrappy Minnesota today in the quarterfinals of the Big Ten tournament in Indianapolis. It was Michigan State's 6th straight win and 9th in its last 10 games, but if the Spartans were trying to impress the NCAA selection committee, well, there's always that game Saturday against the winner of the Ohio State-Wisconsin game. The Spartans today shot less than 48% and had 16 turnovers, and they threatened one of their lowest point totals of the season until Minnesota was forced to foul in the last 90 seconds. Illinois coach Bruce Weber says the Illini will likely open the Big Ten tournament this evening without Chester Frazier. Even if they manage to beat 7th-seeded Michigan without their best defender, Weber says Frazier's hand injury will probably sideline him through the weekend. The 2nd-seeded Illini tip off against the Wolverines at 5:30 in Indianapolis. The Chicago Bulls are on the road in Philadelphia tonight. It'll be the first time Philadelphia sees former 76er John Sammons wearing a Bulls uniform. The 7th-year swingman has given Chicago some nice production since coming in from Sacramento last month. The Philadelphia native has averaged 22.8 points and 7.3 rebounds in his last 4 games. And the Chicago Blackhawks and the Columbus Blue Jackets face off at the United Center tonight. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria Restaurant in downtown Champaign, now serving dinner and tapas nightly starting at 5 p.m., along with Friday and Saturday lunch and brunch menus. Registration is available for emails on news, menu changes, and upcoming special events.
Hybrid cars are all the rage, but Mike Ree reports another car could take the concept of green-friendly vehicles a step farther.
These new type of cars are called neighborhood electric vehicles, or NEVs for short. Now, to me, they look like souped-up golf carts, but don't say that to Matt Stewart.
It gives them a bad name.
Stewart is the senior automotive equipment analyst, kind of like the car expert for the city of Chicago. It owns 4 of these small electric vehicles. And Stewart doesn't like comparing them to golf carts because he says NEVs are much more sophisticated.
They can go faster than golf carts. I think golf carts are allowed to go up to just under 20 miles an hour. These go between 20 and 25 as the top speed. They have safety glass windshields. They have mirrors. They have turn signals, brake lights, headlights. And then they have automotive certified safety belts.
Okay, so NEVs are not golf carts. They're road-ready and fully electric. The vehicles are charged with just a regular wall plug and can go up to 40 miles on a single charge. And this year, Chicago's approved these vehicles to drive around nearly everywhere in the city.
Hi, Garrett.
How you doing?
Garrick Mueller is a truck driver for the city of Chicago. We're standing in this huge warehouse that's filled with fire engines, garbage trucks, and, of course, some NEVs. Mueller says he uses this little vehicle all the time to move around the warehouse. We buckle in.
We're all set. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. This is wild.
Isn't it? It's pretty neat.
Okay, so we're about to go on a regular street.
Yeah, this is a regular street, Elson Avenue. We're going to make a right, and we'll make a right down the next street. People look at you, you know, they're like, what is that? You see them, how the cops right there were just looking at us. They're like, what is that? You know, it's like when you see a new car on the street, you're like, wow, look at that.
Now, the ordinance that they've passed would allow, like, everyday people like you and me to have one of these at home.
Right.
What do you think about being able to drive this around your neighborhood.
You know, I like it. I would definitely drive one of these. I mean, it's the doors come off in the summer if you had, you know, kids and stuff. You can go to the ice cream parlor, have them seatbelted in, and go right to the ice cream. You know, it's nice.
That's actually the goal.
That's Eileen Joyce. She's Assistant Commissioner of Chicago's Vehicle Fleet. Right now, Joyce says the city's testing out the NEVs for its lighter travel needs. Say a worker needs to drop off a box of pamphlets at a concert, or a few employees need to drive downtown for a meeting. Granted, those kinds of trips are the minority compared to most of the city's work with large vehicles like garbage trucks and snowplows. But Joyce says the city wants to show residents how useful these vehicles can be. And if they catch on, she says it could make a big impact on reducing pollution here. She imagines NEVs parked in driveways and garages everywhere.
Plug it in overnight, go and run errands, go to the grocery store, the library, you know, Blockbuster, return something, and come back and plug it in without using any fuel or emitting any, you know, emissions into the air.
Joyce says 39 states permit these smaller vehicles to be used in some form or other. Some businesses have already started using NEVs for things like food and pizza delivery. So you may not have seen one yet, but it probably won't be long before you do. For the Environment Report, I'm Mike Rhee.
Not long ago, if you wanted to buy eco-friendly at the grocery store, your options might have been limited to granola and beans in the bulk bins. Then stores started carrying organic produce. Later, vegetarian fast food appeared. Devin Brown reports now eco-friendly is hitting convenience stores.
They're called eco-venience stores, and they're showing up all over the country. The point is that they sell convenience store food, only greener.
We have organic hot pretzels. It's organic flour.
That's Melissa Rosen. She co-owns a new eco-venience store in Los Angeles called Locally, which is actually spelled L-O-C-A-L-I. And they've got hot pretzels, but organic, hot dogs, but grass-fed. The store even looks like a convenience store. It's in a strip mall. It's near a freeway. They have cold drinks in the fridge and impulse items like candy near the cash register. The customers are in a hurry, but a happy hurry. They rave about the chips.
It's a flavor explosion in your mouth. It is beyond savory.
And the slushies.
Slushy, there you go. The slushies are amazing.
But then you get a little bit closer, and you see that the cold drinks are not soda or beer. They're kombucha, the fermented tea. The candy is vegan gummy bears and organic lollipops. And the slushy, their signature item, is sweetened with agave. There are a few 7-Eleven staples that are missing from the shelves, like cigarettes and lotto tickets. The owners say there are no green versions of those. Some of Locally's products are really pragmatic and not that exciting, like energy-efficient light bulbs and ecological laundry drops. Others are kind of sensational, silly, really.
For example, vegan condoms, what does that mean? What is Glide? Why, you know, I didn't know my condoms weren't vegan.
So vegan condoms, vegan caviar, snow cones sweetened with brown rice syrup, they have this really big variety of products that have never been greened before. And so the question becomes, will new green products like these, however silly, really mean new green consumers? Matt Kahn is an environmental economist at UCLA. And he thinks maybe so.
So the goal might be just buzz, that if you only sold fluorescent or green light bulbs and a tofu turkey burger, people might say, yeah, that's the green place. But if you do some truly wacky stuff, that generating this green buzz might be the way to tip, and even a Dick Cheney would come with his grandson after hearing that it's this wacky.
Which is more or less the point. Locally wants to recruit new green consumers, consumers who right now live in neighborhoods that don't really have supermarkets, and so they buy most of their food at liquor and convenience stores. Of course, one of the problems will probably be price. A 16-ounce slushie at Locally is $5.49, while a 22-ounce Slurpee at 7-Eleven is just $1.40. But Kahn, the economist, thinks because Locally is smaller and more flexible than, say, a Whole Foods, it might actually have a better shot at making it in new neighborhoods.
And so a smaller business might have to pay only a couple $100,000 rather than multi-million dollars to build a big box store. And that lower fixed cost of entering a market makes it more likely that these smaller green stores would experiment more.
And apparently the Ecovenience experiment is something that a lot of people want to try. In the first 6 days of business, the owners received phone calls from people in Seattle and D.C. and cities all over Southern California. And they all asked the same thing. How soon can we open a Locally in our own local neighborhood? For the Environment Report, I'm Devin Brown.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
Zoe Heller is getting quite a reputation as a novelist. She makes brilliant observations about awful people doing bad things. In Notes on a Scandal, a middle-aged teacher sleeps with one of her students, and then her close friend rats her out. Now another collection of delightfully difficult people in Heller's new novel, The Believers. Take Audrey, for example, a dragon of a woman, a mother who never took to motherhood. NPR's Linda Wertheimer talked with Zoe Heller about The Believers.
My favorite thing that Audrey ever does is she comes to the table with a tin of, I think it's spaghetti and meatballs, which she pushes out from the can in a solid, congealed cylinder and then proceeds to slice up into
right.
kind of coin
Slices
shapes.
It into portions. It makes one think of cranberry sauce.
Exactly.
Master Chef Audrey is the wife of a famous liberal lawyer. In the beginning of The Believers, he has a stroke, then lies unconscious in the hospital for most of the novel, with his family orbiting around him, unhappy with themselves and vicious to one another.
I'm afraid I rather alarm people when I say that I see quite a lot of myself in the characters I write. And I think they have all kinds of charms and virtues.
One of the things I think that is very striking about the character of Audrey, and to some extent also the character for daughters, is that she is a different kind of feminist hero, it seems to me.
I don't know whether she's a feminist hero. She certainly doesn't toe the feminist line. She's enormously unpleasant about other women. She's not overflowing with sisterly feeling, or indeed motherly feeling for her daughters. There are some very clear reasons why she has become a monstrous person, and I hope that I generate some empathy for her plight. Among other things, she has the misfortune of being married to a great man. I think she feels she never achieved her potential, and as a result, she is a disappointed woman.
The book is called The Believers, I assume, because the main characters are losing their faith.
Yes, in varying degrees and in varying ways. I think it's called The Believers because it's about a group of people who have the gift for conviction and what happens to them, as you say, when fissures start to appear in the edifice of their beliefs. And I think what the book suggests is it is heroic when you can unblock your ears and take in new intelligence that threatens to contradict your most passionately held beliefs.
Now, the character who sort of personifies the idea of having a very strong faith in something and losing it and looking around for another mm-hmm. is the character Rosa, the youngest daughter.
Rosa is somebody who has spent most of her life as a revolutionary socialist, and then having spent 4 years in Cuba, she has become painfully disillusioned with socialism. And in the course of the book, she becomes increasingly interested in Orthodox Judaism.
You write about her loss of faith very early in the book. I wonder if you could just read part of that for us.
Okay. She is talking about what it has been like to have lost her faith in socialism. All her adult life, she had imagined herself striding along in history's vanguard, like one of those muscular heroines in a Soviet constructivist poster. Now she'd been thrown back into the ignominious ranks of bourgeois liberalism. She'd become just another do-gooder, hoping to make a difference by taking underprivileged girls on museum trips.
Now, one of the things that Rosa has to put up with is her mother making unmerciful fun of her interest in Orthodox Judaism.
Yeah, Audrey is not open-minded about this development in Rosa's spiritual life. She's very tough on it. You know, I remember my own mother saying to me when I was young, there are only two ways you could disappoint me, darling, by becoming a Tory or by becoming a nun. Luckily, neither of those things happened to me. But I remember thinking, that's a bit hard, Mum. You know, you can't announce in advance that there's something I can do that will disappoint you. Audrey is much harsher than that.
At one point, she refers to the God that Rosa is interested in as some kind of cranky old man who gets upset when Jews eat a prawn, a shrimp.
I think the line is, she thinks there's an old man in the sky who has a heart attack every time a Jew eats a prawn. although I'm afraid I'm cleaning that up for your listeners. Lots of people in the world behave just as unpleasantly as my characters do. And I'm slightly irritated by what I think is a kind of modern demand for characters you can root for, characters you would like to be friends with. Speaking as a reader, I have to say some of my favourite characters in literature are the nasty ones.
Well, I was just going to say that you have lots of a very funny little four-line portraits summing up your characters. There's a younger sister Rose's sketch of Carla, her sister who is the fat one, who has always been desperate for her parents' approval. And Rosa says, she reminded Rosa of one of those people who spend four utterly miserable unfriended years at college and then turn up years later as president of the alumni club. I mean, now there's something to make you squirm.
But now, Linda, you raise the subject of Carla. Here's a lovely character. There's nothing nasty about Carla, right?
That's right. Nothing nasty. She's a little pathetic, but there's nothing nasty about her. That's true.
Well, now, wait a minute. Now, you're being harsh. I love my Carla.
One of the things that I think is certainly striking about this book is, you know, you made me read it all the way to the end. I mean, I was never tempted to throw the book out the window because I didn't like these people. I wonder how you approach that task of keeping the reader with you.
With great difficulty and anxiety. In some ways, I wish I could relax a little bit about that. I have this slightly childish sense that, you know, I will only be a proper writer if I manage to finish a great big kind of Icelandic doorstop. But I keep on producing quite slender novels. So one of these days I'm going to produce this vast book and no one will read it, but I will be satisfied.
Zoe Heller, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Linda.
Zoe Heller's new book is called The Believers.
Zoe Heller was interviewed by Linda Wertheimer.
Earth and Sky.
In the midst of modern ills affecting the world's oceans, oceanographer Jeremy Jackson likes to recall ocean success stories.
The importance of these success stories is that they provide a kind of a model and an inspiration for people.
Jackson, who is with the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, spoke about endangered fisheries off the northeastern U.S. that recovered after fishing was limited. He mentioned the Northern Line Islands, an isolated strand of island reefs in the central Pacific Ocean.
You dive on those and you feel you really are in utter wilderness. As soon as you go down, you see lots of sharks, you see lots of fish, and you see lush growth of corals that is three-dimensional, like an underwater forest.
Jackson said the Northern Line Islands prove healthy corals can and do exist. He's also encouraged by the creation of three large protected marine monuments in the Pacific in early 2009. Jackson said scientists know how to save ocean reefs and fisheries.